Peter B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, November 23rd, 2020, as we head toward Thanksgiving and your humble host's impending retirement. This is one of the final News and Comment podcasts I'll be producing. The last one will be this Wednesday. And I am delighted and relieved to report that minutes before I sat down to report this podcast, I learned of the decision coming out of Michigan. The Board of Canvassers has met and certified the election and the victory of Joe Biden over Donald Trump. And I reach for my favorite early punk act from Detroit, the MC5, and that is Kick Out the Jams. And I don't know how you want to reflect on this or express yourselves, but I am elated and relieved because this appears to be the beginning of the end of Trump's desperate schemes to overturn the vote of the public and grab the election back from the jaws of defeat. And because of the way that the maneuvering was going on, and over the weekend, this failed Senate candidate put in his own request that the canvassing board delay certification of the Michigan election results for 14 days, I was concerned that Trump's gambits may gain some traction. Because here's my bias. In 2016, as most of you know, I stuck my neck out and I wagered five big American dollars with my buddy Tom Frank that Trump was going to win. And I based that on my research over the 4th of July in the summer of 2016 when I visited relatives in Detroit. They were all anti-Hillary, most willing to take a chance on Trump. And just before I left from Detroit to come back to California, I had lunch with an old boss of mine, a mentor of sorts, Dave Roberts, who has since passed away. And Dave didn't want to get too explicit. He kept his politics kind of close to the vest. But he smiled and he said, "You know, Peter, I'm not leaning to the left like you do." He said, "I lean a little to the right." And he was very firm that he was going to vote, that he wasn't going to vote for Hillary. And I politely left it at that. And that was my personal focus group, family members, people I encountered, and Dave Roberts. And on the flight back is when I kind of ran those numbers in my head and I said, Michigan's going to go for Trump. And so as I approached this election cycle, and after the way Michigan just devastated Bernie Sanders in the primary, after giving a big win, an upset win against Hillary in 2016, I thought this is still a pretty red state. These people are still drinking the Trump juice. So today, this Michigan board that was obscured, you'd never heard of it before, the State Bureau of Elections, which is comprised of four people, two Democrats and two Republicans, the vote was 3-0 with one abstention to certify the results. And one of the Republican members of the board, Norm Schinkel, he abstained. Maybe he thinks that will make him less of a target for the malicious tweets that are sure to come from Trump if they haven't already. So the proceedings included a presentation by Chris Thomas, the former director of that group, a special advisor to the city of Detroit for the 2020 election. And he said, look, the board has no discretion to do anything but certify the election because the 83 county clerks had already canvassed the results. When asked by Schinkel, the Republican member, if the board could adjourn without taking a vote, Thomas said there was no reason to leave without doing their job. You are the endgame, he said. You've got winners, you've got losers, you don't have ties. Not everyone gets a trophy. And the other Republican member on the canvassing board, Aaron von Langeveld, was leaning toward certifying the results. He asked multiple times if the board had the legal authority to do anything other than certify the results. He's quoted as saying, "I've had a pretty good chance to look at the law. There is nothing in the law that gives the authority to request an audit. I think the law is on my side here. We have no authority to request an audit or delay or block the certification." So the proceedings followed this drama where last Tuesday night, the Wayne County, Detroit canvassing board initially deadlocked. Trump made phone calls. This is so unusual and inappropriate for the president to be leaning on local officials to try to manipulate the outcome of an election. Anyway, the following morning, well, wait a minute, the Republican two members, Monica Palmer and William Hartman, they both initially voted not to certify the results. Then after massive pushback from local officials and average citizens in a Zoom meeting, they said later that they had been pressured into changing their votes. So they did that. Then they got the phone call from Trump, and then the next morning they tried to withdraw their vote. That was not permitted. So then Trump upped the ante, and like a mafia don, he insisted that seven different officials, lawmakers from the state legislature in Michigan, including the state Senate majority leader and the current Speaker of the House, come to the Oval Office for a meeting. They said that the meeting was about COVID-19. That's bullshit, and everybody knew it. Then the Michiganders sallied over to the Trump Hotel down the street from the White House, where they were drinking $900 bottles of Dom Perignon until late in the evening. And, of course, you can't drink that through a mask. Despite all that lobbying and inappropriate pressure and leverage from Trump, they said, well, you know, we haven't seen anything that really changed our minds about this. No evidence that there's some reasonable basis to delay or repudiate the results. So, in my view, and I, when it comes to dirty deeds, we cannot discount the resourcefulness of Trump and the goons around him. But with Michigan safely beyond his grasp, I do not see a way he can manipulate the outcome in Pennsylvania or anywhere else to the point that it would reduce the Electoral College margin that Biden has below 270. And likewise, I don't see how Trump can get to 270. And on that basis, and I'll tell you, I wrestled with this over the weekend. I am going to follow through and end the News and Comment podcast on Wednesday. My commitment to you was to see it through to the resolution of the election. I think we're there. But I'll say this, that if things change, if circumstances do spin out in ways that I can't foresee, I will return to the podcast to address that after Thanksgiving sometime. So the sequence of events on Saturday night was we learned of the blistering court ruling from a federal judge in Pennsylvania, Judge Matthew Brann, B-R-A-N-N. And we know he's a good guy because ultra-conservative Republican Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey said, oh, even though Obama appointed Judge Brann, he's a good conservative Republican. I always cringe when judges are based on who appointed them or what their party was before they put on the robe and sat behind the bench. Because judges are supposed to be nonpartisan and impartial. And yeah, I use the shorthand of, oh, that's a Trump judge who, made this decision. But in the good old days, he said wistfully, sounding like a geezer. Once you got on the court, you were supposed to leave your partisan history behind. At any rate, Judge Brand just eviscerated the arguments that had been made on Thursday in his courtroom by Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, and Jen Ellis, that special team defending Trump. So on Saturday night, 37-page opinion, he found the campaign's arguments unclear, hard to thread together, at one point comparing them to Frankenstein's monster. He wrote that the campaign failed to clear the critical first hurdle of having standing to bring the case at all. Brand wrote that in asking the court to undo millions of legally cast votes, he would expect a plaintiff to come formidably armed with compelling legal arguments and factual proof of rampant corruption. However, he said, that has not happened. Quote, this court has been presented with strained legal arguments without merit, speculative accusations unpled in the operative complaint and unsupported by evidence. In the United States of America, this cannot justify the disenfranchisement of a single voter, let alone all the voters of its sixth most populated state. Our people, laws, and institutions demand more. So Giuliani and Jenna Ellis, she's this young evangelical blonde package, and she's in the Kellyanne Conway zone as a very accomplished spinmeister. Well, she attempted to spin the loss as a win, saying that it would help them move more quickly to getting the U.S. Supreme Court involved. Now, they've got to get to an appeals court that can overlook the lack of evidence and all of the other criticisms of Judge Brand. And then they have to get that before the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, it is still potentially possible, but I think the tide has turned in a way that Trump can no longer affect. The campaign had attempted to shoehorn fraud theories into claims that Pennsylvania election officials unconstitutionally gave counties a choice in deciding whether to let voters cure defective absentee ballots. The campaign brought two Pennsylvania voters to the case, both who had their ballots canceled. One failed to put his ballot in a special secrecy envelope. That's what they called a naked ballot. And there was a whole ad campaign reminding Pennsylvania voters that you couldn't submit a naked ballot. And each of these two plaintiffs lived in counties that decided not to give voters a chance to cure the ballot deficiencies before canceling them. And they're saying that that was unfair. But, of course, two cases can't overturn a margin of tens of thousands of votes. And, of course, we won't make you suffer through a recap of Rudy Giuliani's antics in that courtroom on Thursday. So the case is dismissed on Saturday night, and at that very time, Sidney Powell, who was represented as a member of the this highly skilled legal team under the direction of America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, and she was on TV, I think on Newsmax or someplace, where she was spewing more wild theories about how there was massive shifting of Trump votes to Biden and that there were payoffs made to election officials in Georgia to achieve that. So Powell issued a statement because on Sunday, Rudy Giuliani and Jen Ellis issued their own statement saying, Sidney Powell? Oh, she's a lawyer practicing on her own. She's not part of the Trump legal team. She's not a personal attorney for the president. So sometime between Saturday night and Sunday night, Trump decided to bounce Sidney Powell from his highly skilled legal team. So Powell responded with a statement that I received here on Monday morning. I agree with the campaign statement that I am not a part of the campaign's legal team. I never signed a retainer agreement or sent the president of the campaign a bill for my expenses or fees. My intent has always been to expose all the fraud I could and let the chips fall where they may, whether it be upon Republicans or Democrats. The evidence I'm compiling is overwhelming that this software tool was used to shift millions of votes from Trump and other Republican candidates to Biden and other Democrat candidates. Now, let me stop there. If there had been a tool available to the Democrats to shift votes, not only to Biden, but to Senate and House candidates, don't you think we'd be seeing a very different result right now? I mean, this is where their claims, we can't even call them arguments, just don't pass a basic bullshit test. But I digress. Let's go back to Sidney's statement here. We are proceeding to prepare our lawsuit and plan to file it this week. It will be epic. Whoa. Now that's Trumpian-style hype. She continued, "We will not allow this great republic to be stolen by communists from without and within, or our votes altered or manipulated by foreign actors in Hong Kong, Iran, Venezuela, or Serbia." Serbia? I thought she had been blaming a server in Germany. Anyway, who have neither regard for human life nor the people who are the engine of this exceptional country. I don't know where the regard for human life came in. Anyway, she says, "We the people elected Donald Trump and other Republican candidates to restore the vision of America as a place of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." You mean making America great again, again, and again? Oh, yeah. So now I'm turning to a report from The Guardian. Trump had referred to Sidney Powell's involvement in his legal efforts, saying that she was part of a team of wonderful lawyers and representatives, spearheaded by the Rudy. And the Guardian account continues, "Powell made headlines with her statements at a Thursday news conference, where joined by Giuliani and Ellis, she incorrectly stated that a server hosting evidence of voting irregularities was located in Germany." See? "That voting software used by Georgia and other states was created at the direction of the late Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, and that votes for Trump had probably been switched in favor of Biden." Now, probably is not a legal basis. It just isn't. Probably is like, what, horseshoes and grenades? In a subsequent interview with Newsmax on Saturday, she appeared to accuse Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp and the Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger of being part of a conspiracy involving a voting system contract award that she contends harmed Trump's re-election bid. "Georgia's probably going to be the first state I'm going to blow up, and Mr. Kemp and the Secretary of State need to go with it," she said, adding that a lawsuit she planned to file against the state would be biblical. Holy cow. Judgment Day, right around the corner. So even one of the president's stoutest defenders, a guy who helped him prepare for the first debate and advised him to interrupt Biden repeatedly, then got the COVID, described it as a pretty hairy experience, Chris Christie, the outsized former governor of New Jersey. On ABC Sunday morning, he said the president should give up his legal strategy. "Elections have consequences. We can't continue to act as if something happened here that didn't happen. The conduct of the president's legal team has been a national embarrassment," Christie added. Now note that both he and Rudy Giuliani are former U.S. attorneys. And Christie criticized Trump's lawyers for proffering false conspiracy theories. "They don't do it in the courtroom," he said, suggesting that they're fearful of making baseless arguments under oath before federal judges. And Christie concluded, "It must mean the evidence doesn't exist." So, as I had referenced earlier, now I'm citing the Washington Post, At the beginning of Thursday's news conference, Giuliani said that he, Jen Ellis, and Sidney Powell, and other attorneys present were, quote, representing President Trump and were representing the Trump campaign. Ellis described the group as an elite strike force team that is working on behalf of the president and the campaign to make sure that our Constitution is protected. But by Sunday, their statement said Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. Right under that bus over there. She is not a member of the Trump legal team. She is also not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity. So, in between golf rounds over the weekend, Trump changed his mind. But he didn't blast tweet her into oblivion. In a rare move, he allowed Giuliani and Ellis to lower the boom on Ms. Powell. So here's more from Pat Toomey, Republican senator from Pennsylvania. Quote, President Trump has exhausted all plausible legal options to challenge the result of the race in Pennsylvania. I congratulate President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris on their victory. They are both dedicated public servants. I'll be praying for them and our country. Lisa Murkowski pressed Trump to permit the formal transition to proceed. And so Trump, of course, has to trash Toomey for that. He tweeted that he is no friend of mine. And at this point, it's safe for most of these Republicans to come out against Trump. He may tweet at them, but he'll be, shall we say, verging on toothlessness as he heads into oblivion. And Philip Bump at the Washington Post speculates about what Sidney Powell did that Rudy Giuliani didn't, that required her to be shoved off the island here. And he first begins by saying, it wasn't that Powell said things that were obviously untrue. Giuliani himself delineated a whole battery of nonsense at last week's news briefing. Claims that were not only presented without evidence, but also that depended on purported evidence that the team said it was intentionally withholding. What Giuliani claimed was less obviously nonsense than Powell, but it was still nonsense on a grand scale. All right. As the process of elimination continues, he adds, it also wasn't that Powell's claims themselves met with Trump's disfavor. Her false allegations about voting machines altering the results had been hyped repeatedly by the president both before and after her appearance. And one more, nor was it that Powell's performance was uniquely embarrassing. Ask an American what happened at the news conference, and you're far likely more to hear about Giuliani's performance and his hair dye dripping down his cheeks than about anything that Powell did. And even Republican and pig-hugger Joni Ernst, the senator from Iowa who got reelected remarkably, must have been that software, quote, to insinuate the Republican and Democratic candidates paid to throw off this election, I think is absolutely outrageous, and I do take offense to that. After all, Ernst won, so it can't be rigged, right? She went on to say, to have that accusation just offhandedly thrown out there, just to confuse our voters across the United States, I think is absolutely wrong. Oh, and it was Newsmax. Did I say that right? I don't remember. Anyway, Powell was on Newsmax on Saturday night. So eventually we'll find out what it was that she did that irritated Trump enough that she had to be bounced from this little wagon train. And the media apologists for Trump have started to move on. I heard Rush Limbaugh this morning, and instead of talking about the technical issues of the election and how it was rigged and stolen from Trump, he was focused on the disloyalty of various Republicans who have spoken up timidly and cowardly, at minimum calling for the transition to go forward, and at the max, saying that Biden has won. And maybe it was Tucker Carlson I don't know exactly. Trump doesn't buddy up to him as much as Sean Hannity. But when Tucker went public and said, look, I invited Sidney Powell to come on and bring her evidence, and she got angry and didn't. That's when the little mother, Tucker, said, look, I don't think they have any evidence here. And for a primetime Fox anchor to make that move was it was signal. So they now have to, of course, rewrite history. But they're shameless people, and they operate in a medium that is very immediate. Very few people remember what Tucker Carlson said a week ago, a month ago, a year ago. And they will take advantage of that immediacy amnesia that so many right-wingers have. And just say, oh, okay, Tucker's now, he has pivoted to the old Tucker, the pre-Trump Tucker. And in case you think I'm just gunning for the right-wingers, Rachel Maddow's never going to apologize for her mistakes in covering Russiagate. She just pivots to whatever is next, and the viewers follow sheepishly or sheep-like. That is how mainstream media works these days. The New York Times did some digging. They analyzed the data at Facebook and Twitter, and they have determined that Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr., and allies of the president and himself are essentially the super spreaders of misinformation. They quote Fadi Karan, who is a director at Avaaz. Because of how Facebook's algorithm functions, these super spreaders are capable of priming a discourse. There is often this assumption that misinformation or rumors just catch on. These super spreaders show that there is an intentional effort to redefine the public narrative. So, across Facebook recently, there were about 3.5 million interactions, likes, comments, and shares on public posts referencing Stop the Steal during the week of November 3rd. Of those, the profiles of Eric Trump, Diamond and Silk, they're these black women who support Trump, and a guy named Straka. Who the hell is Straka? Sorry, I missed that on the previous page. Anyway, they were responsible essentially for seeding the clouds. About 200,000 of those 3.5 million interactions. And they say, while this group's impact was notable, it didn't come close to the spread of misinformation promoted by Trump himself. Of the 20 most engaged Facebook posts over the last week containing the word election, all were from Trump, according to CrowdTangle, which is a Facebook analytics tool. All those claims were found to be false or misleading by independent fact-checkers. And the voter fraud claims have continued to gather steam in recent weeks, thanks in large part to prominent accounts. A look at a four-week period starting in mid-October shows that Donald Trump and the top 25 super spreaders of voter fraud misinformation accounted for almost a third of the interactions that people had with that content. It's a trickle-down phenomenon. It comes from the top, and then it mushrooms when it hits the peasantry. Well, we now have 100 chief executives urging Trump to let the transition of power go forward. We have over 100 former national security officials who have made the same demand of Trump. Senator Rob Portman, who was once a moderate Republican from Ohio. He's from Cincinnati, where I grew up, and I know people who know him. And he has been kind of a chameleon during the Trump era, tiptoeing around, taking that advice from Bob Corker not to poke the bear. But in an op-ed published in the Cincinnati Enquirer, or the Enquirer, as they call it locally, He said that Trump has lost the, or came close to saying that Trump has lost the election. Quote, based on all the information currently available, neither the final lawful vote counts nor the recounts have led to a different outcome in any state. In other words, the initial determination showing Joe Biden with enough electoral votes to win has not changed. So you notice how he's backing into the conclusion that his supporters and constituents should draw. And that is that looks like Biden won, but it doesn't look like Trump lost. We can't possibly utter those words. And the Washington Post contacted all 53 Republican senators for comments on the president's efforts to overturn the election results. Fewer than 10 of those Senate offices even responded. The three who are already out of the closet, Collins of Maine, Romney of Utah, Sass of Nebraska, they offered statements. But most of the rest of them just ducked. You got to go to Fred Upton, who is an ally of Biden's. He's a Republican senator from Michigan. There was controversy back in 2016 because Biden went and headlined a fundraiser for Fred Upton and not the progressive Democrat who lost to him. So what happened next is that Carl Bernstein, who is the less celebrated member of the Watergate duo Woodward and Bernstein, he put out a series of tweets on Sunday, and he exposed 21 Republican senators. And he said, look, I'm not violating any pledge of journalistic confidentiality in reporting this. 21 Republican senators, in conversations with colleagues, staff members, lobbyists, White House aides, have repeatedly expressed extreme contempt for Trump and his fitness to be president. He went on to say, with few exceptions, their craven public silence has helped enable Trump's most grievous conduct, including undermining and discrediting the U.S. electoral system. Let's name names. Let's start with Rob Portman of Ohio, because we were just talking about him. Lamar Alexander, Tennessee, Ben Sass, Nebraska, Roy Blunt, Missouri, Susan Collins, Maine, Lisa Murkowski, Alaska, John Cornyn, Texas, John Thune, South Dakota, Mitt Romney, Utah, Mike Brown, Indiana, or is that Braun? Todd Young of Indiana. I don't know either of those jokers. Tim Scott of South Carolina, Rick Scott of Florida. Turning the page here, Marco Rubio, Florida. Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Burr of North Carolina. Toomey, we just mentioned. McSally of Arizona, she's done. Jerry Moran of Kansas and Pat Roberts, his retiring colleague. And Richard Shebby of Alabama. Will this exposure cause them to say, well, I guess I've been outed. I guess I'm vulnerable to tweets from Trump. Should I protect my own reputation? And some of them will wait. The slavishness, the complicity of these Republicans really has known no bottom. And I continue to say that Trump has not yet reached bottom in his machinations to try to hold on to power. And today, as another installment in my last interview series, we catch up with the psychiatrist who has written books about George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. Each one of them is, for example, the latest book is Trump on the Couch. And that would be Dr. Justin A. Frank. And he and I have formed a friendship remotely. We've never met in person since he published the Bush on the Couch book, which is about 2004 or 2005. And in a conversation that touches on narcissism, on the slavish devotion of 70 million plus Americans to Trumpism, knowing that he is a liar and a con man. Justin Frank also talks about something that he commented on in his book, Trump on the Couch, the built-in destructiveness of this man.
He has consistently revealed the extent of it, that it really is to tear down the Justice Department. It really is to tear down all government services. It is to tear down check and balance. And it is to tear down the electoral process. And if it wasn't so dangerous and incendiary and frightening because of the relentlessness of it, even though he's got these clowns like Giuliani promoting his legal case, it would really be funny. But it's not funny. You can't laugh at this. This is really destroying our faith in the electoral system. 70 million people probably aren't even that the election was real or was not rigged in some way. That's a disturbing. And that's all. That's not Trump's fault only. That's Fox News and all these other things that everybody's talking about. But the fact that it's been so far reaching and this kind of destructiveness, that it makes you realize that the Constitution is really a piece of paper and an idea, but it's not necessarily, doesn't have the kind of teeth that we thought it might have had, at least so far.
That's Dr. Justin Frank. He's the author of Trump on the Couch. And I think you'll find my final interview with Dr. Frank fascinating. I really enjoy talking with him and learn a lot about his analytical approach to the president and his behavior. And he's got a great sense of humor, too, which I enjoy. The Washington Post today is trying to fact-check the claims from Sidney Powell and others about how Dominion voting machines and its their software deleted votes for Trump and swung the election toward Biden. And the Post notes that among the accusations are the deletion of votes, and that Sidney Powell also claimed Dominion software was created at the behest of former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to win elections in Venezuela. And the Post says while there's no evidence for any of those accusations, they debunk the alleged ties to Venezuela in detail. They're bringing fresh attention to the way U.S. elections are run and to private companies like Dominion that have long played a starring role in the process. This is so frustrating for me because it takes phony claims of election manipulation by a right-wing nut to bring the issues of the vulnerabilities and liabilities of our election system into sharper focus. So anyway, the article goes on to say that Dominion Voting Systems, founded in 2003 in Canada, now has offices in Denver and Toronto. They offer software and hardware for elections, including the ballot marking devices that are at issue here. Now, one of the things that hasn't been raised by Sidney Powell or any of the Trumpers is that Georgia rushed these new systems into implementation. They were not properly certified by the appropriate federal commission. That issue has not been raised at all. Instead, it's these vague notions of a sweeping conspiracy and then the addition by Powell at the last minute here that payoffs from the voting machine companies to the elected officials running the elections were part of the package. So they cite Wenka Lee, who is a computer science professor at Georgia Tech. He says, look, if your home has a security system, it's probably not foolproof. Does that mean that yesterday somebody broke into your house? Come on, he said. And Alex Halderman, who is a University of Michigan computer science professor who has demonstrated the hackability of these voting machines, he said, scientists like me have been warning for years and years that computer voting machines pose cybersecurity risks. All of that is very different from drawing the conclusion that the 2020 election was rigged, which is an absolutely extraordinary claim. Halderman also argues that if Republicans are really concerned about election integrity, they would have more seriously considered the legislation aimed at fixing the problem and the money that was appropriated in the House Heroes Act that the Senate never addressed in any way, shape, or form. I want to take a second here to thank Many listeners who've supported me over the years with your subscriptions at PayPal or by direct mailing in of checks and cash to my P.O. box, your generosity and your devotion to my work is something that I will always remember. And I remind you, if you still have a PayPal subscription order, please cancel it. We are asking that you not make any further contributions beyond the end of November, and I will be refunding any contributions that come in after December 1st of any amount. But I can't cancel your PayPal order, so please do that before you forget, okay? And feel free to send me an email if you don't think I have your email address in my subscription files so that I can alert you if I do post a podcast in the future. And Joseph Clarici is a guy who I've actually met. He lives here in the Bay Area, and he came out to a Veterans for Peace event a few years ago over in Berkeley, and I got a chance to spend some time with Joe, get to know him a little bit. And he's a bright man, and I really appreciate his sentiments here. He said, "Sorry to see the show winding down, but you've more than earned the vacation. I assume I'm already on the list for future updates. You are. But if not, please add my email. As I remember, I started listening to the show shortly after I graduated from college and moved back to the Bay Area when I was working at KGO. And it's hard to overstate the importance of some of the issues, sources, and perspectives it's turned me on to. So many thanks for that." He said, "I'm fortunate to have the kind of job where I'm able to take in podcasts all day if I want to. And the only upside of you hanging it up is that maybe I'll have more time to catch up on some of the others." So he listed a bunch of sources here. One is Scott Horton at Anti-War Radio. I've interviewed Scott. I know his wife, Larissa, from way, way back there. And I think Scott is a very credible voice in the podcast universe. He also references Congressional Dish with Jennifer Briney. He says, "This is another one you hipped me to. I describe this as the X-Files of political podcasts. There are two kinds of episodes, the one-offs where she looks at a specific bill on health care or transportation or something, and the other ones that tie into her larger analysis of the world economic system and how it impacts U.S. foreign policy." And he lists some others, and I'm going to save those because sometime in December, I will release a podcast with listener interviews, and that's where I'm going to sum up all of these suggestions for other podcasts and news outlets that listeners to this podcast might enjoy. Joe, thank you for the Valentine. It's not seasonal, but I appreciate it. Now, as I've mentioned, I am not going to, because I'm going to be gone in a couple of days, I'm not going to break down all of the details of the bad appointments that Joe Biden has already announced, and there are more in the pipeline. But today, his transition office announced plans to nominate Alejandro Mayorkas to be Secretary of Homeland Security, Avril Haines to be Director of National Intelligence, that is the first female to take that job, and a surprise, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State and Senator and failed presidential candidate, will be the Special Presidential Envoy on Climate, and I would call that a czar position. Also, the campaign office has, or transition office has confirmed that Biden will nominate his old loyalist, Antony Blinken, to be Secretary of State, and Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor. Also, Biden will nominate Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be Ambassador to the United Nations. She is the only one of this group that I've ever talked to. She had a perch at the Center for American Progress back during the Bush administration. I believe she also served as State Department officer in Africa in several nations. And I found her to be bright and quite capable. So if you want commentary on some of these appointments, let me ask you to go to Mint Press News and read the work of Dan Cohen. Cohen published this piece both at Mint Press and at the Gray Zone Project today. I'm not sure how all that works, but you have your choices on where to find it. And he goes into some detail about the hawkishness of the circle of advisors who've been named so far. Michelle Flournoy has not been publicly named as the Secretary of Defense, but that's highly likely. She and Blinken have been in cahoots for quite a while. They are all protégés of the military-industrial complex. They have swung through the revolving door and been fed at think tanks and on board of directors posts. So, as I said, I am not going to drill into all this. I will simply mention that these are the same brilliant people who, during the Obama administration, took the Nobel Peace Prize president into murky wars in Syria and in Libya. And I don't know any one of these individuals who's been named so far who publicly opposed invading Iraq in 2003. And Blinken was the advisor to Biden on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the full title of it. But one of the people who's been most critical and vocal is Stephen Zunis, a man I have great respect for. He's a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, and he is still feeling singed from being stiff-armed by Biden and Blinken back in 2002, when he and other academics were not permitted to testify at the Foreign Relations, that's the word for it, the Foreign Relations Committee hearings, where Biden was an enabler for George W. Bush in ramming through approval of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. I often criticize BuzzFeed for all those damn listicles and their Kardashian-style reporting. But this is a good piece today under the byline of Addie Baird. And her headline reads, "There's no Democratic reckoning coming over their unexpected election losses." And because that pesky software just didn't deliver Democratic victories for the House and Senate, we've seen the infighting, and she recaps it here. Abigail Spanberger and Connor Lamb claiming that progressives and defund the police nearly cost them their seats, and there are 8 Democrats who ran in those turnover districts from 2018 who lost, and it's all the fault of the Democratic left. And Addie's biggest takeaway, each side feels they have enough evidence to support their own view, and there are no signs of any serious soul-searching for the party as a whole. Now, after Hillary Clinton's drubbing and the interference of the Democratic National Committee and the superdelegates who rammed her confirmation through as the Democratic nominee, well, there was a postmortem. Norman Solomon. Oh, what is her name? She's a union activist from Sacramento. Sorry, I'm blocking on her name. But there were about 4 people who pressured the DNC to hold hearings, and they did succeed in basically limiting the role of the superdelegates in the 2020 cycle. It didn't matter because it wasn't a contested convention. But I give them credit for forcing a reckoning over the loss, and there were some attempts to address the serious flaws in the party's rules and policies. Looks like nobody's interested in that in 2020. But what will probably remain is the accusations from Spanberger and Lamb that it's those damn leftists who are ruining it. And as I've said repeatedly, the real issue is that these moderate candidates don't know how to fend off the lying accusations that come from the Republicans. And it's much easier to blame them on AOC or Bernie Sanders or the Squad And I think that we're going to see the Democrats move even further to the right in time for the 2022 election. Well, Trump was invited to participate by Zoom in the G20 summit, which was held in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. But he preferred to play golf because climate change has made November a decent golf month, even in Washington, D.C. And so instead, while he was golfing, he submitted a video message where he trashed the Paris Climate Accord. He said, "To protect American workers, I withdrew the United States from the unfair and one-sided Paris Accord." He went on to say that the agreement was not designed to save the environment. It was designed to kill the American economy. Oh, thanks. So helpful. So well-informed. And so persuasive. So around the G20 summit, as I said, it was held virtually, but the principals were in Saudi Arabia. And it is reported that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu flew to Saudi Arabia for a covert meeting with the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This is reported in the Israeli press on Monday. But the Saudi Foreign Ministry flatly, publicly denied that such a meeting had taken place. The Foreign Minister of the House of Saud, Prince Faisal bin Farhan, denied that any meeting with Netanyahu had taken place. But I wouldn't be surprised. They are probably hoping to lobby Trump for some sort of a military strike on Iran before his time runs out. Jonathan Pollard, American citizen, convicted of spying for Israel, sentenced to life, did 30 years, has been paroled since 2015. And as another gift to Israel, who has long demanded a swap of almost anything for Pollard. And it really is important to note that Israel gets special treatment. If I support BDS, I'm anti-Semitic. But if you call out Israel, a nominal ally, for working with an American spy. And it went on for several years. His disclosures exposed the abilities of American spy agencies, potentially damaged intelligence collection, risked exposing secrets and personnel. Well, this is a very serious breach of our so-called alliance. And I've never heard any apology from Israel for it. Instead, they've just made very strong demands for him to be released in exchange for almost nothing. And so, in general, I believe when people have paid their price, their so-called debt, that they should be released, they should be free. In this case, I have reservations. Here in California, Governor Newsom imposed a COVID-related curfew, 10 p.m. to 5 a.m., in most parts of the state that went into effect on Saturday night. And because my late-night gallivanting is pretty much behind me, I don't consider this to be a very big deal. And also, I will note that it's not really being enforced. It's basically a strong recommendation. And I continue to be troubled by the wave of emails that I get every day from Mark Crispin Miller. He's a professor of media at New York University. We've been longtime allies on election integrity on many issues. We share skepticism about official narratives on many narratives. But in my view, he has lost his compass. And he is so virulently against the management of the pandemic, any kinds of restrictions, including, you know, wearing face masks. He's bitterly opposed to lockdowns. And he will seize on any source of information that advances those biases. And I'm disappointed in Mark because over the years, he's provided a lot of great information from his daily news briefings at newsforunderground.com. But it's now just a whole steady stream of what I consider to be conspiracy theories. So today, he distributed a report from Breitbart. The headline is deeply misleading. It says, Californians defy Governor Newsom curfew order, flood streets in 16 cities. Well, Breitbart has evidence that there was a rally with a couple of hundred people in Huntington Beach and another one in San Clemente. And some people gathered in Santa Barbara. But they don't demonstrate any evidence of the other 13 cities in California where they claim there were massive protests. They accept the representation of protest organizers. The very final, well, not quite, the near the end of the story, between a lot of cheesy ads, curfew crasher protests were planned in San Clemente, Yorba Linda, Huntington Beach, Riverside, Temecula, Brentwood, Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, Patterson, Redland, Sacramento, San Diego, La Quinta, Beverly Hills, and Brentwood, according to organizers. So they didn't even attempt to run down to establish that there really were 16, and yet they ran that headline. Now, I acknowledge that people are chafing at the restrictions that have been imposed, at the business impacts of various rules, like you can't dine inside a restaurant right now in many parts of California. There has been a heavy economic impact. There's no doubt about it. But I believe some people have lost any sense of balance. And as the case count surges, as hospitals, including in California, face capacity, ICUs face capacity, the death toll is not as high as it was in the spring, but it is still significant. Anywhere from 1,000 to almost 2,000 people dying across the country on a daily basis from COVID or COVID-related issues. And I want to thank my friend Ginger. She is the volunteer producer of my local TV show here in Marin County. And a very thoughtful person. And she sent me a link to this report about protests in Denmark. Take a listen.
Hello, you're listening to Hugo Talks. Well, this is a good example of the power of the people and also the power of the media, because I haven't heard anything about this, not through the usual news channels or even the alternative news channels. At this moment, there is literally nothing about what's just happened in Denmark.
Now, what he shows is a scene, but we don't have a timestamp. We don't have a way of verifying that the visuals that he's showing are recent or are related to the report that he is offering. Now, I don't doubt that there have been protests in Denmark. They went through a phase where there were very few restrictions, and that has changed. And as he is about to describe here, there's some of these restrictions that I definitely do not support. But like Hugo, our reporter here, I haven't seen any coverage in mainstream outlets of these protests in Denmark. And also across California, I survey the media here every day. No reports beyond Huntington Beach of significant protests here in California. Much of the California action is driven by a right-wing effort to recall Governor Newsom, which is underway mostly in Southern California. And so they tagged on to the new curfew that was announced. At least that is my analysis. Let's return to Hugo here in Denmark.
The government in Denmark had proposed a new epidemic law, which was not going to be temporary. Just to give a brief summary, this new law, it included, one, people infected can be forcibly given medical examination, hospitalized, treated, and placed in isolation. Two, government would be able to define groups of people who must be vaccinated. 3, people who refuse the above can be coerced through physical detainment. Yes, this was the new law that they were proposing to put in, to bring in. But Denmark have been protesting for the last 9 days because of this law. And after 9 days of the protest, this law now has been abandoned. Apparently Denmark have been protesting en masse with pots and pans outside their parliament. Now this is...
So the visual he shows is a crowd of a few hundred people outside the parliament, and they do have pots and pans. So this could be, an entirely legitimate report. And I share his concern that the corporate media often filters things like this out. And I support the right of people to protest. And I think that, if there is any effort to compromise or collaborate with the government, I certainly don't support mandatory vaccination or detention of people who have different approaches or just a noncompliance approach. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. The worldwide case count is up to 58.4 million with 1.4 million deaths. Across the United States, 12.4 million cases. And yesterday, they reported 141,000 new cases. That's a 54% increase over a 14-day average. The total U.S. death count now is just over 257,000, and there were 843 deaths yesterday. That is a 64% increase over the 14-day average. And I pointed out repeatedly that the Monday numbers are always lower. Weekend reporting is not as complete as what you get on the weekdays, and we can expect those numbers to increase over the next few days. Case numbers are spiking across most of the United States in 48 of the 50 states, leading to dire warnings about full hospitals, exhausted healthcare workers, and expanding lockdowns. The governors of Iowa and North Dakota ordered residents to wear masks. Here in California and in Ohio, the curfews are now active. And with more than a million new cases a week, federal officials have urged Americans not to travel for Thanksgiving, and many are observing that advice. And deaths are averaging 1,200 a day and continue to rise. The big news today, it seems like Mondays, are the announcement of new vaccines that are making progress. This time it's AstraZeneca saying that late stage trials show that its COVID-19 vaccine is highly effective. This is the project that was done in cooperation with Oxford University. And what is interesting to see is, once again, these are not peer-reviewed reports we're getting. They are press releases. And AstraZeneca has many features that compare more favorably than the announcements that have come from Pfizer and Moderna. We'll get into the details of the money structure in a bit. But the biggest feature of the AstraZeneca breakthrough here is that it doesn't need to be frozen. It can be maintained at refrigerator temperatures. But the initial announcement was it was 70% effective. Then they report it's 90% effective. Okay. Then you break that down and they say, well, we found that if you give a half dose of vaccine followed by a full dose a month later, it's 90% effective. But if you give them two full doses a month apart, it's 62% effective. Now, averaging 90 with 62 doesn't get you to 70. And Linda noted here, I don't see how they're figuring this. The average strikes me as irrelevant since people aren't going to be receiving averaged doses. And so, once again, I approach this skeptically. These numbers do not make sense. They are marketing figures. Now, AstraZeneca says that its structure will not produce a profit during the pandemic. They've reached agreements with governments and international health organizations that put its cost at about $2.50 a dose compared to Pfizer at $20 and Moderna $15 to $25 per injection. And when we drill down into the numbers, all right, the New York Times today has a kind of a question and answer format, an explainer. And it says Pfizer, for example, recruited 43,000 volunteers, waited for 170 people to develop symptoms of COVID-19 and get a positive test. Out of one of those 170, 162 got the placebo, and only 8, and previously that number was 5, had received the real vaccine. From these numbers, Pfizer's researchers calculated the fraction of volunteers in each group who got sick. Both fractions were small, but the fraction of unvaccinated volunteers who got sick was much bigger than the fraction of vaccinated ones. The scientists then determined the relative difference between those two fractions. And that difference is called efficacy. All right, I get that. But 8 people. How do you manage side effects? How do you project that onto a much larger population of people with a whole range of maladies or predisposed conditions or current illnesses? And how do you vouch for the safety of a vaccine that has only been administered to a small group of people in these fairly large studies? Now, again, I'm not expert at these things. I'm not any kind of a doctor or anybody with immunology or epidemic pandemic expertise. I'm just a guy. But when I read this, it doesn't make sense to me. So Trump's appointee to run the Warp Speed program to distribute the vaccines, chief advisor Dr. Moncef Slaoui, who has huge conflicts of interest, asked if he'd be open to speaking with the Biden administration because, of course, he owes his job to Trump, and Trump has not green-lighted any transition cooperation. Well, the doctor said he'd be happy to share information that's already public, but nothing confidential. Wow, isn't that great? So the U.S. now has plenty of ventilators. There was a big shortage back in the spring, if you recall. But now there's a shortage of medical personnel trained to operate the ventilators. Dr. Lou Kaplan, president of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, said we're now at a dangerous precipice. Ventilators are exceptionally complex machines that require expertise, constant monitoring for the weeks or even months that patients are hooked up to them. The explosion of cases in rural parts of America has prompted local hospitals that lack such experts on staff to send patients to cities and regional medical centers. But those beds are quickly filling up. A couple of minutes ago, I mentioned the reports of protests from Huntington Beach, California to Denmark, and a new poll from Harvard found that a majority of Americans support mask mandates, but they want their states to stay open. 54% said they wanted their states to try to manage while staying open. 46% they believe their state should return to lockdown. 77% said they support a nationwide mask mandate. 23% oppose it. The experimental antibody combo treatment that Trump received when he went to Walter Reed Hospital after he tested positive has been approved for distribution on a trial basis. The biotech company Regeneron received approval from the Food and Drug Administration either on Friday or over the weekend, and so it will be available on a limited basis. The evidence so far suggests that antibody treatments work best before the virus has gained a foothold in the body. Regeneron's product is not authorized for use in people who are hospitalized or who require oxygen. Over at the American Prospect, David Dayan makes an important contribution to the discussion about vaccine distribution. He said that Project Warp Speed is designed to get it to 50 states, 8 territories, and 5 large U.S. cities. But it's the last mile or last couple of miles that is really unaddressed. There's $200 million that's been earmarked to help facilitate all this. But when you get to the local health department level, the competing health maintenance organizations and hospital groups, so far, we're not aware that there is any plan for how all of that gets worked out. And finally today, I want to recommend a piece by Alan McLeod at Mint Press News. He takes on the announcement from AstraZeneca and Oxford about their vaccine. And he notes the business model is very different. The profit motive has been largely taken out of the equation. He quotes Dean Baker, the senior economist at the Center for Economic Policy Research. There was this absurd view that somehow we could only get good drug development with the lure of a patent monopoly. The Moderna case is noteworthy because basically the government paid the full cost of developing the drug up front. We did also give them patent monopolies, but since the government already paid for the research, this was a handout to the company. And the different business models are what would enable the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine to be distributed at under $4 per injection rather than $20 for Pfizer or $25 for Moderna. And this is one of the issues that has long troubled me, that the scientists who are incentivized to develop cutting-edge medications and vaccines have an investment in that. They are permitted to hold the patent to profit from it, even as they receive grant funding and their salaries from an academic institution that they're affiliated with. I think these are deep conflicts of interest, and I hope someday we will see them sorted out. Thanks for listening to one of my final news and comment podcasts. Feel free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.